This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org, and I'm Maria Armudian. The closeness that may develop between presidents and their vice presidents rarely continues after their term ends. But Presidents Eisenhower and Nixon seem inextricably bound to one another, partly as a result of Nixon's political tactics and also from the development of family ties. It wasn't a particularly good relationship, as our next guest has documented, but the relationship endured and shaped the United States politics and policy for decades to come. Jeffrey Frank is with us now. He is a journalist and author of several books, including this one, Ike and Dick, Portrait of a Strange Political Marriage. Welcome, Jeffrey Frank.
Hi, thanks to be here.
It's great to have you here. I wanted to start with the general characters of these two former presidents, Dick and Ike, as you call them. It seems like they both had an enormous capacity for deception.
These were two men that could not have been less alike when they first met. And it was sort of like a dance around each other. Eisenhower, the whole country called him Ike, even though he was one of only four or five-star generals. And he was sort of a beloved figure, a truly beloved figure. He's the one who had led the Allied Expeditionary Force on the Normandy invasion. He was basically the leader who defeated the Nazis in Europe. Nixon, he was 62 years old, looked a little older, grandfatherly. He smoked three packs a day. That probably got to him, a lot of coffee and a war. Nixon was a 39-year-old Orange County senator at that point. And Eisenhower had met him briefly a couple of times, but they did not know each other. And although it's always said that Eisenhower picked Nixon, in fact, he was picked for Eisenhower by a number of advisors. Later on, Eisenhower was asked, how did you actually select him? And Eisenhower said, well, it was a list of six people, and he was on the list.
Nixon had failed in a number of careers. How did he rise to the presidency, and how would you contrast that with Eisenhower?
Eisenhower basically won the presidency by acclamation. Both parties wanted Eisenhower to run. The Americans for Democratic Action wanted Eisenhower to run. Franklin Roosevelt's son, Jimmy, wanted Eisenhower to run as a Democrat. Everyone wanted Eisenhower. At one point, they were talking about having him run as a Republican and a Democrat. They would separate these two parties by having different vice presidents. That was just a notional idea. Nixon, on the other hand, struggled and struggled and struggled. And he had a rise and a fall and a rise again. And just to quickly go through his history, he ran for Congress in 1946, running against a five-term Democratic incumbent. He won partially because he was young and a veteran and a really good campaigner, partially because he was using the red issue, the communist issue, which was just beginning to show up. It wasn't as big as it was going to be after Senator McCarthy made his famous speech. And he won partly because he had the support of the Los Angeles Times, which at that point was not only the dominant paper, but the political director was also the man who wrote the editorials. He was the man who wrote a column, and he loved Dick Nixon, and he really wanted him to be in Congress. So he won that race. He won it pretty substantially. He won again. Then he ran probably the campaign that people never forgive him for, or at least Democrats never forgive him for, in 1950 against a woman named Helen Douglas, who was also a congresswoman. She'd had three terms. And that was his nastiest campaign. That's when the red issue really came in with full intensity. He was coached by a man named Murray Chotiner, who was sort of the Karl Rove of his day. Murray Chotiner, his sort of dictum was, destroy your opponent. That's how you win a race. And Nixon really went after her. And he won by a substantial margin. He won by 600,000 votes. The only one who had a bigger margin in 1950 was Earl Warren, who became governor of California. And in the summer of 1950, Nixon was invited to the Bohemian Grove, this exclusive men's club north of San Francisco. And the host-in-chief was Herbert Hoover, the former president, who loved the Bohemian Grove. And he also invited Dwight D. Eisenhower, who at that point was president of Columbia University. And Eisenhower was invited to give a lakeside talk, the sort of important talk of the event. And people were already talking about Eisenhower for president again, this time as a Republican. Of course, no one at the Grove wanted him. They were really quite conservative, this bunch, and they wanted Bob Taft, a senator from Ohio, who sort of satisfied them. But anyway, Eisenhower was there, Nixon was there. They talked briefly, and that was their first meeting. And they met once more in Paris when I was helping to set up NATO. And then they showed up at the convention. Eisenhower was the favorite of the Eastern Republicans, and Nixon was kind of being pushed by a number of Eastern Republicans, including the former New York governor, Governor Tom Dewey, and of course his friend Murray Chotiner, which really annoyed Earl Warren, who hoped himself to be a favorite son candidate from California. This is the delegation that Senator Nixon was in.
The Bohemian Grove, you mentioned that you had a whole chapter on it.
Yeah.
And you said it's different from other exclusive clubs as well. How was it different?
Well, in one way, it was all men. They had these sort of ritual, the sort of the famous the cremation of care ceremony. It was very secretive, sort of. Less so now. You can actually go on YouTube and go to Bohemian Grove, and you'll see the torchlight parade and all that sort of thing. The clientele were wealthy businessmen, show business personalities. In those days, people like Edgar Bergen. Actually, the summer that Nixon was invited by Herbert Hoover, he wanted Conrad Hilton, the hotel guy, who thought they could maybe give them some tips on catering this summer. There were no women, and there still are no women allowed, I suppose partly because the men prance around naked at one point, but there are some women who help out with serving and so on. Herbert Hoover called it the greatest men's party on earth, and so it was a big deal. Nixon, later on in the tapes, was not very nice about it, but at the time, he was really happy to be there.
Now we have President Eisenhower, well, before he's president, when he's running, and he essentially lets other people choose Richard Nixon, Dick Nixon, to be his running mate. He didn't even know, as you said in the book, that he could choose the vice presidential candidate.
No.
And he never really liked Nixon all that much.
He didn't, I won't say he disliked him, but he was never really fond of him. They were so different. As a general rule, he didn't like professional politicians. Tom Dewey, the man who sort of worked hardest, or one of those who worked hardest to get him nominated, I still couldn't stand him. There are a couple of exceptions. Henry Cabot Lodge Jr., who was a senator, but he qualified as sort of being from a good old Eastern family. He was sort of in Eisenhower's sort of circle in a way, but no. Nick was sort of a scrappy hustler to Eisenhower and staff. He was still Lieutenant Commander Nixon, and Eisenhower was still General Eisenhower. You have to remember, by the way, that Eisenhower, when he left the presidency, did not want to be addressed as Mr. President. He wanted to be General Eisenhower.
You implied that they both had this ability to be kind of cruel, or that maybe even Nixon picked this up, cruel while appearing to be warm and kind.
Yeah, I mean, Nixon did some terrible things later on. But in their relationship, while Eisenhower was president and Nixon was under him, it was Eisenhower, and I'm not saying that even Eisenhower was intentionally cruel. It was sort of a casual cruelty, not being really aware of how he was deflating Nixon, hurting his feelings. I mean, he was constantly slighting him. First place, there was, I don't know if you want me to go into the fund scandal, but right after they were both on the ticket, Nixon went to visit Eisenhower in Fraser, Colorado. I'm not sure it was bonding or whatever. And Eisenhower tried to teach him how to fly fish. Eisenhower loved fly fishing. He loved bridge and he loved golf, none of which Nixon could do none of it. Nixon later on forced himself to learn golf. I actually interviewed a man who caddied for him the summer he was teaching himself golf. And so he was a disaster. You could actually look at, there's a URL in the index of the book where you can sort of see a newsreel of Nixon trying to cast and catching the hook on his chest. So that's sort of a disaster. So they go off. Nixon's on in the West Coast and Eisenhower is sort of in the Middle West. When the New York Post breaks a story called Nixon's Secret Fund. It wasn't really a secret. Nixon had actually told another reporter about it. It wasn't, by today's standards, it wasn't even much of a scandal. $16,000, all of which was accounted for in pretty good bookkeeping, was being used to supplement his office expenses. But it just didn't sound good, and it particularly didn't sound good at a moment when the Eisenhower campaign was, let's clean house with Ike and Dick. And by cleaning house, they were talking about Harry Truman and the Truman scandals. Harry Truman himself wasn't implicated in it, but the people around Truman were sort of, there were all kinds of things going on. Government contractors were, there's a 5% bonus that was being paid. Mink coats were being given out. Deep freezes were being given to people. Actually, Mrs. Truman got a deep freeze. And I think they claimed that, oh, well, it broke down, so it really doesn't count. So it was called the mess in Washington. So it really was bad to have even a taint of scandal. So Eisenhower, at one point, told reporters this, we have to be as clean as a hound's tooth. That was a famous thing. And he pretty quickly wanted Nixon to leave the ticket. His good friend, General Lucius Clay, thought Nixon should go. The man Eisenhower was probably closest to all his life was his brother Milton, who definitely thought Nixon should go. But Eisenhower being Eisenhower, and Eisenhower was that he couldn't act directly. Eisenhower couldn't say, Dick, I want you off the ticket. He just let Nixon hang there, and they finally gave him the chance to go on national TV to explain himself. Eisenhower said, I want you to explain every nickel, every dime that's ever come in. And there was a sort of full-scale audit of all of Nixon's finances by Price Waterhouse. I think 50 people worked day and night. And so Nixon had to give this speech. And before he went on, he asked Eisenhower, so after I'm done, will you make a decision? And Eisenhower said, well, let's just give it a little more time. And Nixon said a very rude thing, which I can't repeat on the air, but in his memoirs, in one memoir it came out, General, there comes a time when you have to fish or cut bait. But that still wasn't. Just before Nixon went on the air and he to give a speech that was going to explain everything, he got a call from Tom Dewey saying, Dick, I hate to tell you this, but we really think when you finish your speech tonight, you should resign from the ticket.
And
you
can, from the Senate,
and
right?
Yes. Well, then you could really make yourself look good by giving up your Senate seat, too. And then you'll win in a huge special election. And you'll come back a hero. And Nixon just was speechless. He was already nervous, rattled, scared to death. His whole career was going down the drain. And he said, you'll just have to wait. And he did. He gave his speech talking about his finances, the mortgage, how much money he owed, what his parents were, how he'd grown up and worked in a grocery store. He did not mention that two of his brothers had died when they were young. And he finished the speech and mentioned, and it became called the Checker speech because he mentioned that the family had been given a little black and white Cocker Spaniel, and his daughter Tricia named it Checkers. And he said, and we're going to keep it. People today look at it as this maudlin, oozy speech, even though actually Mamie Eisenhower apparently shed a tear. But if you look back at that time, in 1952, looking at a black and white television, this young guy under siege, the Milton Berle show goes off the air, and here's this guy speaking, begging for your understanding. And he defied Eisenhower. He said, write to the Republican National Committee and tell them what you think. And by gosh, thousands and thousands of people did just that, and Eisenhower was kind of trapped. Nixon beat him. The lieutenant defeated the general, and Eisenhower knew it.
This was one of the real attempts for Eisenhower to move Nixon out.
Yeah, that was the first one, the big one. Nixon's daughter, Julie, wrote about it. She said every September 23rd, which was the day that he gave the speech, he would say, you know what today is? It's the anniversary of that speech. And he said one time it was a scar that never healed. His wife, Pat, never got over it. She hated politics from that day on. It was a devastating moment. And even though Nixon went on and Eisenhower went on, that thing was always in the background, I think, between them, even though they never spoke of it again.
So he really outmaneuvered Eisenhower in this.
Yeah.
Was there another incident like that?
Well, 4 years later, Eisenhower was going to run for re-election, and this came after a very difficult and delicate moment. Eisenhower had a major heart attack. No one at the time knew quite how serious this thing was. In the first place, he was being treated by a doctor who really didn't know what to do, and for hours, this doctor sat with him, gave him morphine shots, and it was just by the grace of God that Eisenhower didn't die. In the morning, they called an ambulance. He was taken to the hospital, and even though he was critical, but he recovered, and during that time, government sort of went on without him. Really, no one was in charge. It was basically a government by committee. But Nixon really comported himself well. Everyone really got a high regard for him. He was dignified. He didn't try to assert himself. The press praised him. John Foster Dulles, the Secretary of State, really thought he'd done well. And that was a period when Foster Dulles, no one could have been less like Nixon than Foster Dulles. But Foster Dulles did like Nixon. He began to sort of mentor him in some way. Eisenhower, though, it did something to Eisenhower, the sort of seeing this young guy. And also, Eisenhower really, really wanted to get someone else. As he would say, we need to bring other people up. So he wanted Nixon replaced. They had several conversations in the spring of 56 after Eisenhower recovered and decided he was going to run again. At one time, he offered him a cabinet post. Nick, I think you want to be Secretary of Defense. It'd be good for you to learn to run something. I think he said, you can have any job you want except state, which was going to go to Herbert Hoover Jr., which never would have happened, or justice. And he thought Nixon didn't have the experience for that. But Nixon knew that if, whether or not Eisenhower was trying to help him or not, it would be perceived as if he'd been dumped. And so this went on. And Eisenhower said, I'm going to have a meeting. We're going to discuss the next election. And Dick, I would of course, invite you, but it could be difficult if you weren't there. So we're going to have this. And it went on. These conversations continued. And someone said it was a moment of absolute agony. And it wasn't like the Checker speech because it went on and on and on. These conversations started basically in January. And they didn't end until April, when Nixon again kind of pushed himself back on the ticket. He managed to get himself a New Hampshire senator named Stiles Bridges, sort of organized a write-in vote in a primary in which Nixon wasn't running that showed Nixon had this powerful base out there. And finally, Eisenhower basically saw there was really no way to do it without basically having a public statement, I want him off the ticket. So Nixon survived. Though, even when Nixon thought he'd survived, a man named Harold Stassen, unquestionably with Eisenhower's assent, was trying to promote the governor of Massachusetts, Christian Herter, and then that failed too. And Nixon was not only renominated, but poor Harold Stassen was sort of pushed into doing the renomination.
Let me just remind listeners that we're speaking with Jeffrey Frank, and the book is called Ike and Dick, Portrait of a Strange Political Marriage. Joe McCarthy, very big role at the time. How did McCarthyism play into their relationship?
You know, everyone thinks that Nixon and McCarthy at a certain period were these twin spirits. And in some way, they were both very aggressive sort of red hunters in the 40s. Nixon was a member of the House Un-American Activities Committee. Nixon's reputation came because he went after Alger Hiss, a man named Alger Hiss. For better words, Alger Hiss was convicted of perjury for lying about having passed documents to the Russians. This is a case that people still want to argue about, but that's not the subject of this book. But that made his reputation. Eisenhower said to him, Dick, I think you got him, and you got him fairly. That's the way Nixon wanted to be thought of in the Hiss case. Nixon thought McCarthy was out of his mind, basically. He didn't use that language. He thought he was reckless. He threw charges out. He wasn't being a lawyer and became more and more irresponsible. And after he made his famous speech in 1950s about 205 communists, which then became 57 communists, and not one communist, by the way, ever was shown to be in whatever it was, the State Department, McCarthy started going further and further and began to take on the army. And all kinds of whether a man named Peres was promoted, it gets very complicated. But in any case, this was Eisenhower's beloved army. And after Adlai Stevenson made a speech saying "There's you cannot have a party that's half Eisenhowerism and half McCarthyism," Eisenhower said, enough's enough, Dick, I want you to go on television and take both of them on. And Nixon was happy taking on Adlai Stevenson. He'd done that before. He'd done that in 52 when they ran against him. But taking on McCarthy was a very delicate thing for him because he had to take on someone who was an anti-communist, and Nixon was an anti-communist, and he had to take on someone who represented part of the party's base, and Nixon didn't want to lose that, and yet he understood he had to do it. So he threaded this very delicate needle, and it came at a time after a famous broadcast by Edward R. Murrow had talked about McCarthy basically indicting people without evidence, and so it was somewhat easier, but he hated to make the speech. He hated to have to being ordered to go on the air and attack Senator McCarthy. But he did it. And he did it by not mentioning McCarthy's name, but he said, you know, there are cases when people are accused of a crime and they have a right to face their accusers, they have a right to have a full hearing, and there are people today who are just recklessly throwing these things around. Everyone knew who he was talking about. So he did it, and he pleased Eisenhower. He really annoyed McCarthy, but McCarthy, a year later, was censured by the Senate, and Nixon went on to better things.
Was that the time when President Nixon was preparing to do the speech and Eisenhower said, you must work in a couple of smiles, and he just was
that's right.
Terrified of that idea?
That's right. He had to work in a smile. And actually, this is sort of a funny story. Nixon was completely keyed up for the speech. He went up to a suite in the Statler Hotel in downtown Washington with a guy named Jim Bassett, he'd been a newspaper man who was helping Nixon. Nixon said, this is the hardest thing I've ever done. And Bassett said, I think he seems to have forgotten the fun speech a couple of years ago. And at one point, a famous cabaret singer of the time named Hildegard was singing downstairs. Nixon said, why don't we get Hildegard up and just to talk and so on to our room? And she apparently took it as a huge joke and just said no. I don't think Nixon had anything untoward in mind. He just sort of thought it would be fun to have Hildegard come up.
And this was also, of course, when the concerns over Vietnam were starting to bubble up. Eisenhower initially said that he didn't want to get the United States into another war. What was his strategy? What was Nixon's?
This was when the French were being defeated in a small little battleground called Dien Bien Phu. And Nixon had been there. Nixon had taken a big Asian trip a year before. He knew very well that if the French couldn't hold on, the people who were going to be governing this country was going to be the Ho Chi Minh, the Viet Minh, the communist regime. They were the only ones capable of governing it. Nixon knew this, but he thought America should intervene. And that was the last thing Eisenhower wanted to do, was to get into any kind of war in Southeast Asia. He managed to get us out of the Korean War within 6 months after becoming president. And he could do it because he was Eisenhower. He was the five-star general. He was the supreme commander of the Allied forces. He had promised to visit Korea. He did go, and he basically saw, why are we sending troops in to try and take a hill that we're simply going to lose? This is an unsustainable war. Within 6 months of being president, we got out. There was an armistice, and in a way, that's the situation today. There's basically a ceasefire that's endured for 60 years or so. But Nixon thought we should help the French, but with air power. The Joint Chiefs of Staff, at one point Admiral Radford, thought we should send 3 nuclear bombs go in. You cannot even imagine what would have happened to the world if they had done that. This insane idea, but that was not going to go anywhere. And Eisenhower basically did all he could to stop any kind of involvement. He said, oh, we'll talk to Congress, knowing that Congress would have hated the idea. Well, we'll consult with our allies, knowing very well that Winston Churchill had no intention of helping the French preserve their empire, since the British had already lost their empire. And so Eisenhower very cleverly kept us away from any kind of war there. To be honest, though, Eisenhower did send money to the French. He helped pay for the French war there, and he sent them weapons. But our engagement in Vietnam was at that point limited to very, very little support. And he had helped prop up the Diem regime, which was then, as you know, overthrown when the Kennedys took office. And when he was overthrown, and by the way, this time Henry Cabot Lodge was the ambassador then, and then Lyndon Johnson became president, and the war was then escalated from Kennedy's 16,000 advisors to Lyndon Johnson's 550,000 soldiers, and the war that we've never forgotten.
And we have to talk about the civil rights era, because there was so much that occurred during this time, Brown versus Board of Education. There were a couple of civil rights bills over that period of time. Nixon supported them. Yeah. Eisenhower didn't. What happened?
Well, Eisenhower supported the bills because his party supported the bills. Eisenhower hated Brown versus Board of Education. He hated the idea. He thought it was completely disruptive of the society. It's not something he could say. And he was good about following the law. To jump ahead when there was a big crisis in Little Rock, Arkansas, Eisenhower did the right thing. And he did it in the way a general of the army would do it. He sent an overpowering force. No one was hurt. No one was killed. And the Little Rock Nine went to school. Martin Luther King Jr. met Nixon for the first time in Ghana at the independence ceremonies for the Gold Coast, which became Ghana. And he told people, he said, Nixon, he was raised a Quaker and he seems to be without prejudice. And I think deep down, Nixon had prejudices. Everyone does. But outwardly, Nixon said and did the right thing. And he wanted to do the right thing about civil rights. In 1954, during one of his worst campaigns, he made a stop in Wilmington, Delaware. And someone said, what about, they brought up the Brown versus Board of Education decision, which had come out in May of 54. And Nixon made a very eloquent speech. He said, you know, my daughters go to school with Negroes, and over 600 million people in this world are not white. And if we're going to win their attention or respect, we have to show that we're a society that respects equality. And he meant it. He was the man who worked hard for the administration to support the 1957 Civil Rights Bill, which at the time was sort of a landmark. Lyndon Johnson is given credit for it, and Johnson certainly worked to pass the bill, but Johnson wanted a watered-down Voting Rights Act. And Johnson at that time was playing all kinds of games. He wanted to run for president, so he couldn't alienate the North, but he didn't want to alienate the Southern Democrats like Richard Russell. And Nixon pushed very hard, and the voting rights provision of the 57 Civil Rights Act was stronger because of the administration, and Nixon was the man working for it. Martin Luther King, who met with Nixon several times, praised him for it. Jackie Robinson, who was, I'm not sure he was a friend of Nixon, but they were very, very friendly, and he wrote Nixon congratulatory notes for all the great work you did. And it's important to remember that even the Nixon who later on supported the so-called Southern Strategy, he did work to desegregate Southern schools as president. And unlike George H.W. Bush, unlike Ronald Reagan, and unlike Goldwater, he supported the 1964 Civil Rights Act and did so publicly. He broke with Martin Luther King in 1960, or King broke with him because Nixon did something very cowardly. When King was arrested on a completely trumped-up charge, he had been arrested for driving without a license or something. He was sent in chains off to Reidsville Prison in Georgia. And when Mrs. King called, please help, she was terrified her husband was going to be killed. And she had very good reasons to think he might be. The police in Georgia at that time were horrible, what they were doing to black people in Georgia. And the Kennedy campaign, Bobby and or Robert and John Kennedy, stepped up and did something, and Martin Luther King was released. And I think it's clear that Nixon lost a lot of support from the black voters then. If he had won them, he very well might have carried a couple of more states and very well might have been president.
And you mentioned Kennedy, and that's another important point. He and John F. Kennedy were actually relatively close when they were in the Senate, but then things deteriorated.
Competition will do that to you, right?
Yeah.
I mean, they were very friendly. I mentioned that really nasty campaign against Helen Gahagan Douglas. And shortly afterward, Kennedy spoke to some students at Harvard and said, I'm really glad that Nixon beat her. I would hate to work with someone like her in the Senate. Nixon was invited to the Kennedy wedding. When Kennedy was very ill with a back problem and Nixon was vice president and they had to reorganize the Senate, he preserved Kennedy's spot in the hierarchy. And Mrs. Kennedy wrote to him thanking him, saying she thinks the world of you. They were very friendly. And Nixon was asked to support Kennedy's membership in the Burning Tree Country Club and did so. But when Nixon was nominated for vice president, one of the first congratulatory notes came from Jack Kennedy. But as I say, competition brings out the worst in everyone. When they ran against each other for president, there was a breach between them that would never heal. Kennedy began to speak with them with complete contempt. Nixon just said he was never going to lose an election that way again. He felt the Kennedys were ruthless, and he also felt the elections had been stolen from him.
And when the assassination occurred,
I think that was almost the worst thing that ever happened to Nixon. He was a happy guy then. He'd lost the governorship of California, sort of a humiliation. So that was it for California. He moved to New York. He joined a law firm. He was doing very well. He got an apartment at 810 Fifth Avenue, which is a very nice building. He was in the same building that Governor Nelson Rockefeller had an apartment. He was earning a lot of money. His two daughters, Tricia and Julie, were going to the Chapin School. Pat loved being in New York. They would go to musicals. They would walk down. Checkers was 12 years older. They would go strolling down Fifth Avenue. And Nixon swore to a columnist. He said, I'm never going to run again. I'm not going to run in 68, in 72, in 64. Anyone who thinks I'm ever going to run for office again is out of his mind. And I think he meant it. And then Kennedy was killed, and everything changed. Nixon could begin to taste it again. He could sort of see it again. I think, I mean, there's no question he wanted to. He would have loved the nomination in 64. He already sensed that Lyndon Johnson was vulnerable. And when that wasn't going to happen, the competition came down to Barry Goldwater and Nelson Rockefeller. He already began to look ahead to 68. As a politician, he was like a brilliant chess player. He could see several moves ahead.
During this time, Eisenhower, now General Eisenhower again, had started being ill. He started having heart attack after heart attack.
Right.
How did he treat Nixon when he decided to run again?
He'd had several heart attacks, and as you say, and they got worse and worse. There was something else that was happening at this time, too. In 1967, Eisenhower's grandson, David, announced to the family that he was engaged to Julie Nixon, Nixon's younger daughter, which was an amazing thing. They were kids. They were 19 years old when they announced this, and they were going to get married. And in fact, a year later, when they were both 20 years old, they did get married. And so that influenced Eisenhower's decision. Eisenhower always didn't want to get involved in these nomination fights. He said, I'll support the party's nominee and that sort of thing. And it was a way to avoid supporting Nixon early. But this time there was no way out, and they were sort of a family now. He still waited till pretty much the last moment, but Eisenhower was pretty close to being on his deathbed when he endorsed Nixon. He endorsed him in the early summer of 1968, and in July of that year, Nixon got the nomination for president.
One of the funniest aspects of your book was when there was this famous quote from Eisenhower when a journalist asked about what major idea did Nixon offer you during your presidency that you then adopted, Eisenhower said.
Yeah, if you give me a week, I'll think of one. And that was 1960. It was devastating. Eisenhower told people, oh, I wish I'd never said that damn quote and so on. But he said it. It took a while for him to take it back. Nixon was completely devastated by it. He really didn't know what to do. So what he did do, he went on a talk show. He went on the Jack Parr Show, which was the show that Johnny Carson then took over, which is now being done by Jay Leno. And he had a chance to say, well, you know, Eisenhower, the president, is, of course, right. He does make the final decision, but he had also a chance to say that I was in on everything. I was a vice president. He included me in all of his councils and the cabinet and so on.
Before he passed away, he did get involved in Nixon's foreign policy to some degree. How much?
I mean, at the very end, after Nixon was president, yeah. It turns out to be the first 2 months of the Nixon presidency. And I would say the first 2 months of the Nixon presidency were a huge success. There was no war in Vietnam. I mean, there was the war. It was Lyndon Johnson's war still. Nixon had been warned by a very prescient columnist named David Halberstam, you have about 4 months to find a way to get out of this, or it's going to be Nixon's war. And of course, that's what it turned into. He was being very inventive. The administration, you know, went on to sort of create the Environmental Protection Agency, sort of equal hiring, federal employment. This sort of universal food stamps came along. He had appointed Daniel Patrick Moynihan to sort of advise on domestic policy, and they came up with an idea for negative income tax. Some of these things didn't go anywhere, but it was a very inventive, imaginative administration. And Nixon apparently would sit in some of these meetings himself. And in foreign policy, Eisenhower advised him to stay out of the Middle East, because once you put your hand there, then you become the guarantor of any agreement and so on. And Eisenhower got very involved. He suggested that Nixon should appoint Herbert Brownell, who had been Eisenhower's attorney general, to be on the Supreme Court. There was even some talk about Eisenhower being a sort of super advisor, but that never would have happened. Eisenhower was very, very ill. But Ike would pick up the phone and just say, "Mr. President, and so on." It was the one time when I won't say they were close, and they certainly weren't friends, but there was a real sort of almost equality between them. And they actually, and that Thanksgiving, they'd have a real family dinner together because they were family now. How odd to think of that.
Again, the book is called Ike and Dick, Portrait of a Strange Political Marriage. The author is with us, Jeffrey Frank. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to those who make this program possible. To Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Ankine Arasyan, Melissa Chiprin, Mike Hurst, and Tim Page, most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can check out our archives at scholarcircle.org, kpfk.org, and please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at Armudian, and we'll see you next week.